So I went down to my favorite store, picked out three or four shirts or more, a pair of pants and a striped tie, and the man came by and said, "Yes, sir, cash or charge?" I said, "Just put it on my credit card." Write that dude up.
Our guest for this edition of On Your Money once had $100,000 in credit card debt, but she paid it off in 3 years and turned her financial life around. She is now the money coach and a financial expert at AARP, and a financial news journalist for Dow Jones and CNBC, the author of several money management books for adults and kids, and she will answer your personal finance questions this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our regular On Your Money guest, financial planner Kevin McKinley, is off today, but you can still get your personal finance questions answered by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Lynette Calfani, CEO and founder of the Money Coach. AskTheMoneyCoach.com. She is a financial expert at AARP, and she is also the author of several money management books, including Perfect Credit, 7 Steps to Great Credit Rating, and Zero Debt, The Ultimate Guide to Personal Freedom. And she joins us from her home in New Jersey. Good morning.
Hi, Joy. Good morning to you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for being here. Well, let's talk a little bit about you. You once owed $100,000 on credit cards. How did that happen?
It sounds so awful to admit, but it is the truth, so I might as well fess up. It was back in 2001. I had, as you said, $100,000 in credit card debt alone. Fortunately, I was able to pay it all off in 3 years. I never missed a single payment. And then I lived to tell the tale, and I wound up writing this book, as you just mentioned, called Zero Debt, The Ultimate Guide to Financial Freedom, which, you know, became a New York Times bestseller, a Business Week bestseller. A lot of folks wanted to know, you know, what I did to get out of debt. And as you just said, how did I get in it in the first place? In my case, it was a lot of overspending. I've since learned, of course, that folks who get into debt typically run into trouble in one of two ways. Either you're a classic overspender, as I was, and you're sort of mismanaging your money, or you fall victim to one of what I call the 5 dreaded D's: downsizing, divorce, a death in the family of the main breadwinner, disability, or disease. Because any time one of those 5 things happens to you, it can definitely throw your budget out of whack. And for a lot of people, it forces them to live on credit.
Right. And then it's worse if you start missing payments and the credit card interest rates are high. It balloons, doesn't it?
It does balloon, and it spirals out of control in more ways than one. You know, I do workshops and seminars across the country, and I try to teach people now also that even though, of course, it's stressful and ill-advised to live with debt, especially massive amounts of debt like I previously had, I think one of the most appreciated facts about people who are struggling with financial problems like debt is that most of society sort of looks at it as a financial issue alone, when nothing could be further from the truth. In reality, when you have, you know, very severe financial problems, even if you don't recognize them at the time, like I didn't, believe it or not, and I'll explain a little bit to your listeners why that was, but mostly the financial problems are one layer. There's the stress on your marriage and on your relationships. There's the impact that it might have on your performance and your productivity on the job. It's the way in which your creativity is sapped because you can't really see a greater vision for yourself and how to be more creative and resourceful to perhaps earn more money to help you get out of your dilemma. So, and then, of course, there's the health impact as well. Because of the stress, there's, you know, sleepless nights and anxiety. For a lot of people, there's, you know, sort of that pit in the feeling, you know, that feeling you get in the pit of your stomach. For some people, ulcers, tension headaches, and so forth. So I really try to talk to people about the many faceted ways in which financial difficulties can plague your life so people can get a greater appreciation of why it is that they need to achieve financial freedom.
Yeah. So how did you get out of that debt in just 3 years?
Well, I outlined in Zero Debt a number of strategies, but just to sort of give you an overview, I took a multi-pronged approach. I did everything from negotiating aggressively with my creditors. I didn't get any of my debts reduced, so I actually paid all $100,000 and really and then some. But I did negotiate my interest rates. And because I was a good customer for the banks in the sense that I had always paid on time, even though I was only making minimum payments, I had never missed any payments, so they were willing to negotiate with me. They didn't want me to take my business elsewhere. So when I called them up and said, listen, I need to pay off this debt and I'm in the process of doing so, but can you match or beat this lower interest rate that I've gotten, you know, from one of your competitors? Because I would constantly get additional credit card offers in the mail. And then they all said yes. So I got all my interest rates down. Several cards I had at 0%, 2.9%, 4.9% was the single highest interest rate that I had after I negotiated. I also started doubling and tripling the minimum payments that I was making. Before, I was caught in a rut, and I call it the minimum payment trap, because, again, I know now that minimum payments, you know, here in the short run, because you want a little extra cash flow and you want to feel more comfortable, minimum payments in the short run really mean maximum payments in the long run, because you're just going to pay so much more in finance charges and interest over time. I also started using every windfall that I received to sock towards my debt. So I think sometimes people think about a windfall as being a huge, you know, economic sum. No, I didn't hit the lottery. I didn't get an inheritance. I didn't get any kind of, you know, lawsuit settlement or anything like that. The windfalls, many cases, are the every, you know, not every day, certainly, but the sort of extra funds and money that we receive, sometimes routinely, as in, say, an income tax refund check, or a year-end bonus on the job, or holiday gift money, or maybe birthday funds you might get from a generous relative, that kind of thing. So whenever I would receive those kinds of lump sums or windfalls, additional cash flow in, you know, outside of my paycheck, I would take those extra sums and also put it towards my credit card debt. I cut back on my spending, needless to say, and cut out a lot of the frivolous and or sort of extras that I was doing. I learned to live on a budget. And so as I did all of these strategies, they helped my, I was previously married, and my ex-husband and I were in debt together, and I only had two kids back then. I started to see the debts whittle away. And after about 3 years of doing this, my ex-husband and I ultimately separated and divorced. I'm since remarried, happily remarried, so is he. But we sold some land that we owned in 2004, at the end of 2004, and we took the proceeds from that and paid off $30,000 of the debt. So I'd paid off $70,000 sort of organically up until that point, over the course of 3 years, and then, you know, subsequent to us selling this land, we took that $30,000 and paid off the final portion of it. But again, I outline a whole bunch of strategies, but I, you know, outline maybe five or so that I use.
Well, did you, I mean, did you have to, you cut back on your spending, but did you have to live like a pauper? Did you have to?
Not at all. The crazy thing was, and I mentioned that I'll explain sort of why I was, at the time I actually didn't really think it was a problem. I had a high-paying job. I was earning a six-figure salary. I was a financial journalist. I was a Wall Street Journal reporter for CNBC. And I was giving people money advice. This is, you know, kind of the irony of it. And even though I had this massive amount of debt, I was very much in denial about the fact that it really was a problem. And I was in denial mainly because I did have a good job, because I had never missed any payments, so it certainly wasn't the case that, you know, bill collectors were tracking me down or hounding me. Nobody ever bothered me on the job or called my home. I also had a healthy 401k, a six-figure 401k. I had life insurance. I had disability protection. I'd created a will in case something happened to me to say what I wanted done with my assets and for my minor children. I had an emergency cash cushion as well. So in my head, I was like, okay, I'm doing all these things right. So I was rationalizing it and sort of saying, oh, so what if I've got this, you know, this debt over here? Big deal. It's getting paid. And so I sort of justified it wrongfully, of course. But when I decided to cut back, no, I didn't live like a pauper, honestly. Mm-hmm. What I started doing was being a lot more conscious and a lot smarter about my spending. So lifestyle, some things that I had been doing, traveling, for example, which is still very much my passion, but now I do it and pay cash, or if I'm going to use a credit card, I pay it off that same month. So at the time, it was, you know, I would say, oh, let's go to the Caribbean and put it on a credit card and worry about paying for it later. So that kind of stuff, yes, I did cut back on. Additionally, I was the type of person who, you know, if my friends and I went out to dinner or if my sisters came in town or something and we all went out to dinner, I would say, oh, don't worry about it. I'll treat everybody. So I started saying, you can't do that, Lynette. And so I cut back on that kind of thing. But no, I didn't change my lifestyle in a drastic way that actually crimped, you know, sort of made me feel like, oh, I'm living this kind of life of poverty almost, or austerity. One substantive change that I did make that I labored over and that I really thought about a lot was with regard to my two children. I have three children now, but at the time, my kids, my older two kids were younger. They were literally five and three. Well, she was almost six, the older one, and he was almost four. But they were in kindergarten and preschool. And believe it or not, my kids were in private school, and it was, you know, $20,000 a year for the children each. And how did I pay for that? I put it on credit. You know, I had big lines of credit and you know, access checks that I was able to access, convenience checks through my credit line. And so whatever shortfalls I had when I didn't have the money, I just paid with, you know, use the line of credit. Again, obviously not a smart strategy, would not recommend it to anybody now. But again, subsequent to my divorce, I further restructured my finances. And my ex-husband and I both said, my kids actually went to a different private school. They stayed in private school, a cheaper private school, frankly. After that, once I sort of got resettled and lived in another town, which actually had a phenomenal public school system, which is where I live right now, I transferred my kids, and they're in public school and have been ever since, and they're thriving and doing just fine. So at the time, what I'm trying to suggest is that I really thought, oh, my gosh, I'm not going to be giving my kids the best, and I really struggled with that as a mom. But again, now I know I'm so happy that I made the choice, because I'm able to put money in their 529 plan for college, which is when they're really going to need it. And for us, for my family, it worked out just fine, and it was actually a very smart financial decision.
We are talking with Lynette Calfani-Cox. She is CEO and founder of AskTheMoneyCoach.com. She's a financial expert at AARP. She is a former financial news journalist for Dow Jones and CNBC. She's the author of several money management books for adults and kids, including Perfect Credit, 7 Steps to a Great Credit Rating, and Zero Debt, The Ultimate Guide to Financial Freedom. She is telling us how she once had a $100,000 credit card debt and how she paid it off in 3 years. And we welcome your questions about not only credit card debt, but any personal finance issue. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Money's too tight to mention.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Financial planner Kevin McKinley has this week off. We are instead talking with Lynette Kalfani Cox. She is a financial expert, and she will answer your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's take some calls. Jimmy in Milwaukee is with us next. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a one-month-old son, and he's our firstborn, and we're trying to figure out a good way to open a bank account for him and start saving for college or, you know, something like that. So I was hoping you can give me advice on that.
So saving for college for a newborn son.
Sure. Hi, Jimmy, and congrats on your newborn. Welcome to the club, too. As I mentioned, I have three. My children are 15, 13, and 7, so I fully understand what you're getting prepared for. One good option to consider is a 529 plan, which is a state-sponsored college savings program. And these are really good deals now. I think, frankly, much better than they used to be sort of, you know, more than a decade ago, because they have so many features that make it easy to save and that make it flexible for the student and the family. For example, you can get a 529 plan, not just in Wisconsin, but through any state in the country, California, Texas, you know, Nevada, Florida, take your pick. You essentially pick which state plan that you want, and there are some great resources to help you online. There's a site called savingforcollege.com, for example, run by a fellow named Joe Hurley, who's probably one of the preeminent experts in this category. But essentially, most of the state plans are run by different fund companies. So Tia Kreff manages some of them, Fidelity, et cetera. And the reason that the 529 plans are such a great deal is that you can sock away for your newborn son now, you know, as little as $25 or $50 a month, and really start to see that money grow over time. And when your kid takes it out for college, you get the benefit of that growing tax deferred. And as long as the money is used for higher education costs, you're not going to be taxed on it. Now, you might say, well, you know, if I get a Wisconsin plan or a Texas plan, does my child have to go to a school in one of those states? No. The plan is portable, so you can he can take it with him. And if you have a plan, say, in your home state or in another state, your child can still go to any institution of higher learning in the country as long as it's an accredited school. Another aspect about 529 plans that I like is that not only are they portable, they're transferable. So let's assume you save for the next 17 years until your kid is ready to go off to college, and then all of a sudden he says, Dad, I don't want to go to school after all. I want to go find myself or travel around Europe or something. Well, if you have another daughter, let's say, behind him or another family member or even yourself, if you decide to go back to college, you can transfer the funds in that 529 plan to another person, and that's a really great deal. So that's what I would look into in terms of starting to save for your kid's college education.
Thank you for the call, Jimmy, and yes, congratulations. Raj in Milwaukee has a related question. Hi, Raj, you're on the air. Raj, are you there? Well, he's not. I'm going to ask his question, though, because I think that he was going to say that he has an IRA. Should he get an early distribution or take money out of that IRA to help pay for his daughter's college expenses? Because he apparently doesn't. Maybe he didn't do one of those 529s when she was born.
Right. I wouldn't recommend that. I wouldn't take an early distribution. And just so folks know, the reason why, you know, you can contribute until to your retirement, and you have the ability to do so and take money out of them after you reach the age of 59 and a half. But if you prematurely take money out of a plan, you're going to get hit with a 10% penalty from the IRS, and you'll have to pay ordinary income taxes on it. So depending on the tax bracket he's in, it could be, you know, 30% or so in taxes and a 10% penalty. Now you're talking 40% of your money gone right off the bat. So I wouldn't necessarily do that. I don't like to see people take money out of their retirement accounts in general to pay for their kids' college education. I know it's constantly done. People pull money from either a traditional or Roth IRA, or they just take it from their 401k or 403b plans on the job. But honestly, I really want to see a lot more Americans, especially older folks, establish and maintain financial security. You mentioned the work that I do with AARP, and I can't tell you the number of people who come to me for advice via AARP that regret some of the choices that they made because, of course, they're trying to help their kids or their grandkids, and then their own financial well-being is very much sacrificed in retirement. And so I really wouldn't recommend that.
Well, you also wrote on your The Money Coach website, smart ways to pay for college without student loans. How can you do that?
Right. Well, obviously, you know, the rising cost of a college education has forced a lot of, you know, middle-class Americans to take on student loans. And I understand that if your kid gets into the choice, you know, the school of his or her choice, you want to do whatever you can as a parent. But before you go to the loan market, I suggest that people look at five other sources: scholarships, grants, paid internships, work-study programs offered through the school, and the family's own resources. So just quickly to run through each of those, the scholarships and grants, that's the free money for college. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be paid back, and that should be topping the list of sources and resources that you turn to seek out college funding. The challenge for a lot of students, especially, let's say, the typical high school teenager who is a senior, who is going off to, you know, preparing for their first year of college, is that they have so much going on, all of their academics, of course, but then the extracurricular activities, the sports, the tests that they have to take, et cetera, the midterms, the finals, you know, the SAT, they have so much on their plate that the thought of, you know, applying for scholarships, filling out a ton of applications is very daunting for them. But I do tell those high school seniors, as well as people who are currently in college who are going to their sophomore, junior, and ultimately senior year, is that you really do have to make the scholarship and grant hunt a quasi full-time job for at least 3 or 4 weeks. So you might do it during the summer, you might do spring break, you might do some during the December holidays, but you have to aggressively look for these scholarships. And I recommend you apply for at least a dozen. That will stack the odds in your favor to get a couple of them. And it really does pay off in the long run, because if you get a $10,000 or $20,000 scholarship, you're going to be able to pay for a year of college, and then that will mean $10,000 or $20,000 less in student loans that you have to take on. And those student loans take 10 years or more to pay off, so it's worth it to put in the time. The paid internships are another great option. In the past, people would, you know, do internships, you know, at for free, just because they were getting experience, a foot in the door, they were making connections. That's no longer, to me, a viable option for most people. Not when you're looking at tuition, room and board, and fees at a public college of $20,000 on average and $40,000 on average for private schools. We can't afford to let young people work 10, 15, 20 hours a week and simply get no financial return on it if it means they're going to have to take out loans because their work wasn't paid for. So seek out work-study. Work-study and or internships, paid internships. And when I talk about the family's resources, obviously saving at an early age is best. You want to marshal all the resources you can. Mm-hmm. Even if it's only a little bit that you can save over time, that'll be a help. But there's a way to get other family members involved, too. When you have grandparents, et cetera, who do want to contribute, let them go ahead and contribute, you know, to the 529 plan, for example, as opposed to, you know, giving the kid cash or, you know, buying holiday gifts that, frankly, a year, 2 years later, or maybe 2 months later, the kid is going to forget about it and not even remember. I'd much rather have money contributed to my kid's 529 plan than, say, a new sweater for the holidays.
We are talking with Lynette Calfani Cox. She is CEO and founder of AskTheMoneyCoach.com. She's the author of many books, including Zero Debt, The Ultimate Guide to Financial Freedom. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a personal finance question for her, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Seth in Chicago is with us next. Hi, Seth.
Hi. I just have a question about credit ratings and the effect that perhaps a late credit card payment would have on my rating, and any basic suggestions and strategies you would have for improving a credit rating.
Absolutely. A single late payment, believe it or not, can lower your credit score by 50 to 100 points.
Wow.
That's for someone with good credit. Now, you first need to understand the overall, just a 20-second overview mm-hmm. of the credit scoring world. There are many different types of credit scores out there. The most popular one is the FICO credit score. FICO stands for Fair Isaac Corporation. That's the company that originated those scores and does the credit scoring model for it for millions and tens of millions of Americans. The FICO score ranges from 300 to 850 points. So the higher your score, the better off you're doing in terms of managing credit and debt. And also, with a better credit score, it's going to help you in a lot of ways. Lenders are going to give you the best interest rates and the best loan terms and rates for anything you need, a mortgage, a credit card, a student loan, an auto loan, etc. It'll even help you in terms of having good credit overall to be able to get a job, because a lot of employers are even looking at your credit history, not your credit score, but just your credit profile, your credit report, and determining who to hire, who to promote, etc. So overall, you never want to miss a payment on anything, because within the FICO credit scoring system, the chief determinant of your FICO credit score, 35% of it, is based on your payment track record. 35% is based on nothing else other than how well you pay your bills. So that's why folks who have decent credit, who have good credit, a 700 score or higher, when they miss one single credit card payment or an auto loan payment, et cetera, they'll see their scores typically drop 50 to 100 points. Now, the lower you go down the chain, if you already have bad credit, if you have, say, a 580 FICO score and you miss a payment, then your score is not going to drop 50 to 100 points, because, frankly, you've already done a number of some damage to your credit, and there's already been some history there in terms of one or more factors that probably negatively impacted your credit rating. In terms of overall improving your score, the way that you do that is to know what the factors are. So I told you one of them, 35% is based on your track record. 30% of your score is based on how much credit card debt you're carrying. So you want to keep your credit card balances low. If you pay down credit card debt, you'll see your credit score generally rise. The third factor, 15% of your FICO credit score, is based on the length of your credit history. Again, generally speaking, the longer the credit history you have, the more of a positive boost that is to your credit rating. So don't close out old accounts, especially if you have, let's say, a credit card that you've had for 5, 10, 15 years. Some people pay off those debts and then mistakenly think, good riddance, I'm going to kiss this card goodbye. And they think that'll boost their credit score, when ultimately in the long run it actually backfires. It can hurt your credit score. So try to keep a longer credit history. The last two factors are each 10%. 10% of your FICO credit score is based on the mix of credit that's in your credit files. So essentially you get brownie points for showing the credit scoring gurus, as it were, that you can responsibly juggle multiple forms of credit. So if you have, say, a mortgage, which is obviously linked to housing, a mortgage debt, a primary mortgage, a home equity loan, a home equity line of credit, that kind of thing, that's one form of credit and one form of debt. If you have an installment loan, like a car loan or a student loan, that's another form of debt. If you have a credit card, that's categorized as revolving debt. But if you have all three, for instance, and you're paying all three of them on time, then you actually get brownie points, as I said, for that. So the mix of credit that you have is also taken into account. Better to have a healthy mix of credit than have just one. You don't want to have, for instance, just credit cards in your credit profile. And then the final 10% is inquiries or new applications for credit. You only want to apply for credit when you really and truly need it, because anytime you request a loan or seek credit, a lender does pull your credit rating, and they initiate something that's called a hard pull. And that hard pull stays on your credit record. So an inquiry stays on your credit record for 2 years, and it counts against you for the purpose of calculating your FICO score for 1 year. Now, depending on whose estimates you believe, some people say a single inquiry can lower your credit score, just one inquiry, by anywhere from 5 to 35 points. So, again, you only want to apply for credit when you really and truly need it.
Oh, my goodness.
I hope that helps you.
Oh, I'm glad that you explained all of that. That's really, I don't think I knew every one of those percentages. And that means don't apply for the department store credit card just to get 5% off or whatever.
Exactly, exactly.
And I think it's really kind of crummy that they drop your credit score by 50 to 100 points if you really have been good for, you know, most of your adult life and you've got good credit and you miss one payment. They don't fool around.
I know. That's the irony of the credit scoring system, is that, frankly, you're more harshly punished if you've been a good payer and then you have a blip, because you have further to fall. And so they say, whoa, 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 this is out of character. Something's going on here. This person's credit risk all of a sudden is much more elevated. And remember, the score is really just a three-digit determination. It sort of boils down all of your payment history, and it is really designed to tell lenders and creditors how big a risk you are in terms of what's the likelihood that you'll default on a debt, what's the likelihood that you'll repay a debt. And they categorize you based on your track record. And so the interesting thing is that not only is it potentially very harmful for you to you know, have one late payment when you've had a really solid track record, but there's also a factor in the credit scoring world that's sort of known as recency, R-E-C-E-N-C-Y, meaning how recently did you have something bad go wrong. So this part of the credit scoring world, you know, really can be advantageous to consumers or harmful depending on how you manage and or mismanage your credit. So one late payment that you made 2 months ago, Joy, is going to hurt you far more than a single late payment that you made 2 years ago. And then that 2 year ago payment that was late, that one will do more damage and will harm you more than a payment that was late 6 years ago. So you always want to stay up to date, of course, with your bill payments. But the reality is that as the negative payment or as the blip that occurred gets further away from you, it has less impact and does less damage to your credit score.
Lynette Calfani Cox is CEO and founder of AskTheMoneyCoach.com, financial expert at AARP, former financial news journalist for Dow Jones and CNBC, author of many books, and here to answer your personal finance questions. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org, or make that onyourmoney@WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
When I retire, don't want to have to worry. When I retire, I don't want to have to fret.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is off this week, but we are talking with financial expert Lynette Calfani Cox, author of many books, including Perfect Credit, 7 Steps to a Great Credit Rating. Welcoming your questions about all things personal finance at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Phil in Racine is with us next. Hello, Phil.
Hi. Hey, I'm wondering, kind of, we're at the point, we're retired, and we're at the point where we have to take this minimum mandatory distribution of the IRA.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a mortgage loan of 5%, at 5%. It's about $90,000. But, you know, we're in pretty good financial condition. Lucky to be there. And the thing is, we're wondering, should we use this mandatory, the money coming out of the IRA, to pay down and eventually pay off this mortgage?
What is the balance on your mortgage?
About $90,000.
Okay. And you said, I assume that you're 70 or older, correct?
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And you said also that, you know, we're doing pretty well.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get a sense of other cash and what you had available to, you know, potentially pay off the mortgage. Are you both, you're both already fully retired?
Right.
Okay. And so just quickly to answer that question, do you have other funds that you might possibly tap in order to be able to pay off the mortgage? Or were you just looking at the IRA?
No, just looking at the IRA, really. But we've got money set aside for, you know, emergency purposes.
Okay.
So we feel pretty confident with that. And what my thinking was, well, if things do get tight, then you don't have to pay it down every year. See what I'm saying? In other words, well, if you need the money for, you know, a new well or something on a home or a major thing, major improvement, then we won't. But I was thinking, well, why not put the majority of the money towards the reduction of that mortgage?
I think it's overall a good strategy, obviously, especially when you're no longer working, to try to be completely debt-free and to try not to have a mortgage or frankly, any other loans. The only thing that I would caution you against, and since you are 70, as you mentioned, so you wouldn't be you wouldn't get any penalties or anything like that, and now you're at the point where you have to take it out. But you know, you don't have to take out $90,000 worth, though. Obviously, since you're 70 and it's 2013, you know, let's say you had $100,000 in that IRA. Well, the minimum distribution that you have to take, your first annual required distribution, is going to be less than $4,000, so $3,650 or so. So what you should think about, though, is the what-if scenarios. So you should think about, do we have long-term care insurance? You mentioned that you have a nest egg in terms of an emergency cash cushion, but how big is that cash cushion? Is it, say, enough to, you know, pay all your bills for, you know, a year or more? If you had no other source of cash coming in outside of, say, what you were able to tap in your IRA, perhaps what you might have through a pension, what you might have through Social Security, what would you do if something sort of, not necessarily catastrophic, but something just unexpected that, you know, cost a pretty price tag, what would you do? Would you need those funds that are now in the IRA to be able to handle that kind of emergency or unexpected situation? I don't think that in your case that it would necessarily be a bad move to, you know, become debt-free, but I'm just sort of weighing some of the cost-benefit here. Your mortgage payment is probably what? What is your mortgage payment each month?
About $500.
$500 a month. So that 90-something thousand dollars that you could potentially tap into, okay, you'd make a $500 a month liability go away. That's $6,000 over the course of a year. You know, even five more years of paying, $30,000. You know what I mean? So the trade-off, I think the analysis that needs to be done is really about, do we have enough of a cash cushion? Is it comfortable for us? You have to look at what the overall IRA balance is for yours and your spouse's, if your spouse has one as well, but and say, if we did, you know, more or less liquidate this account or tap into it to make this obligation go away or to make most of it go away, would we still be okay otherwise? So I think it's a question of what other resources you would have at your disposal, especially if you feel like if somebody got sick or if there were some health issues or something else that would trigger big bills, would you be able to handle those?
Good luck to you, Phil. Thanks for calling. Next we go to Shirley in Waukesha. Hello, Shirley.
Hello. I'm a 78-year-old woman who sold her house 5 years ago and put $100,000 of that money into an annuity, which has been paying 3%. Now at the end of 5 years, that interest rate is going to go to 1.5%. And I'm going to be seeing my financial advisor soon about this, and I'm wondering, what are my options at this point? I'm very conservative, and I really don't want to take any risks with my savings.
Okay. Well, you're in a tough situation because we're in such a low interest rate environment, and if you feel very sort of risk averse, the things that are going to get better returns naturally, unfortunately, mm-hmm. have higher risk attached to them. So when you look at the scope of options, if you want to stay on the more conservative side because you are not as risk tolerant, I would look at things like bonds, fixed income funds, and I'm assuming you're going to get out of the annuity because the return is not going to be obviously where you want it to be, correct?
Well, hopefully, yes.
Okay. So in terms of other alternatives for you, certainly in terms of, you know, fixed income investments, you might look at municipal bonds. You know, there's some that I think are sort of better credit quality than others, but you might ask your advisor about that because of the tax benefits that are attached to those sort of triple tax-free in terms of federal tax, local and state taxes, things of that nature. You might think about laddering some CDs, certificates of deposit, where they mature and sort of vest on a rolling schedule. You can do the same with bonds. You said that you're 78 years old, so I wouldn't automatically go, you know, so far out in terms of the time, but you might look at saying having a one-year CD, a three-year, a five-year, and a 10-year CD, something like that.
I'm just wondering, just in general, does she get penalized if she's going to, if I'm understanding this correctly, pull $100,000 out of an annuity to invest into something else?
I thought she was saying that the term was going to be up.
I thought the interest rate was just going down.
Well, the interest rate is going down, and I'm not sure. That's another thing I have to find out. If I can just pull that out and roll it over into something, that might not be. There may be a penalty. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, there. If you do it prematurely, I'm sorry, I misunderstood her question. There almost surely will be. So you definitely want to take that into account. How long have you had it?
5 years.
Okay, I thought she was saying that it was initially intended to be 5 years, and that it was going to. She knew the rate was going to go down, but that the term was up.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you have to ask your financial advisor about that too, Shirley. You know, good luck to you. Thanks very much for calling. Before we wrap up, and we still have a little ways to go, but I wanted to ask you about a story that you wrote on your website about how to save $250 or more on back to school shopping, since a lot of people are doing that right now.
Oh yeah, and I'm one of them.
Yeah.
with my kids. Essentially, you know, the National Retail Federation says that the typical parent is going to spend over $600, $635 or so to, you know, outfit their kids back, you know, for clothes and shoes and all the stuff that they need to get back in the swing of things. And so that's a lot of money. You know, when you start thinking about having more than one kid, it can really add up. But if you're a parent or a grandparent, a couple things that you can do to save money. I always tell people, you know, take stock of what you have first. So kind of check around the inventory in the house. Shop your own closet, so to speak, first. Check the garage, check the attic, check the basement. make sure that you're not going to go out there and duplicate your purchases. If your kids already have something, if they have a backpack that's in perfectly fine, you know, order, don't in good shape, don't go buy another backpack. If they have, you know, pencils and rulers and a calculator, don't buy those kind of basic school supplies, because you're just wasting money. I also talk to people about using the right card. Some people are going to do their shopping online, and so they can, if they do their shopping online, you want to use a rewards card. If you're spending cash, that's, to me, ideal instead of using plastic. But again, I know that some people, maybe they don't have $600 cash to spend, so maybe they're going to spend using a credit card and pay it off over time. Well, if you're going to use a card, try to get one with 0% financing, so you won't have interest attached to that. So I'd recommended a card, the Capital One Quicksilver Cash Rewards Card. It has a $100 bonus right now for people who are going to spend $500. So they get $100 cash back right away. And, of course, there's that 0% deal they've got going as well, so you won't pay interest on it. A number of states have sales tax holidays as well, as a way to allow people to shop, and it's all going on, you know, during the August back-to-school season. And in essence, if you shop during any state's tax holiday, you won't have to pay taxes on it. So in my state, New Jersey, unfortunately, there's no sales tax holiday. However, there is a way for folks to get around. There's not one in Wisconsin either, to my knowledge. Mm-hmm. But there is a way for you to not pay sales tax, which is essentially to shop online via phone or through the mail at another state, and then you'll still be able to not pay taxes on your purchases. For those who are doing shopping online, you definitely want to get free shipping. That'll save you, you know, anywhere from $20 to $50. And then lastly, if you have kids or grandkids, they're going to want to take you to the mall or to get their favorite brands. And I tell parents, you need to emphasize price and just quality, as opposed to going for the latest fads and fashions and style, and which is what the teens are going to want. There was a back-to-school shopping survey done for 2013 by Capital One, in fact, that showed that nearly 50% of parents say price is the most important thing for us when we do our back-to-school shopping. But for kids, only 22% of them thought price the most important thing.
Yeah, sure, they're not paying for it.
Exactly. We emphasize price over brand names.
I'm going to try to get one quick call in before we end. So a quick question and quick response. Mike in Middleton.
Thank you. Got divorced. I know that longevity is part of your credit score. When we had the credit cards, for over 25 years, they're in both of our names. Is there a strategy? They tell me they won't remove the ex-spouse's name from the account, and I didn't want to lose the account because I didn't want to adversely affect the credit score. Can I get the other person removed? Always been paying them for over 25 years. Is it possible?
Yeah, exactly.
Is there a strategy?
Yeah, we have just a minute.
Exactly. Unfortunately, these are very much lender dependent, and most lenders will say open a new account. Some of them might not do an inquiry and make you sort of apply, but some will. And so you'll have to really get, because you definitely want to separate. I've been through a divorce, and you want to separate the credit accounts, and you want to get a new one in your own name, but it'll be a new account number. And some creditors will say, okay, I'm going to pull your credit to see if I should give you on your own based on your individual credit rating and your individual income a standalone credit line, and at what how big a credit line. And others will say, okay, we'll open a new account for you, and we won't do a hard pull. We'll just sort of base it on your track record, but it's very much dependent on each individual credit grantor.
Mike, thank you for the call. Good luck to you. And Lynette, it's been really a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. Good advice, and what an inspiration. Your story really is something to behold. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Joy. Take care now.
Lynette Kalfani-Cox is CEO and co-founder of AskTheMoneyCoach.com. She's also a financial expert at AARP and a former financial news journalist for Dow Jones and CNBC. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing and directing this program. Thanks to Justin Williams for on-air production. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.